I would like to subtitle it or retitle it, Myths of Aging and the Aged. My name is Glenn Granlund. I'm from Minneapolis. I presently work with the Ebenezer Society. A number of people have asked this week, why are you in the field of aging? And I'm not sure I know. But I probably should share with you that as I reflected back on it in the 50s, from 51 to 60, in addition to going to school, I spent a lot of time working in youth work in Luther League and other areas of youth ministry. Then in the 60s, I spent most of that decade in a parish in Iowa, in Waverly, Iowa, at St. Paul's Church. And then after that period of service, about 68, came to Minneapolis and served with the national office of the American Lutheran Church, first in the Division of Parish Education, and then in the Division of Service and Ministry, Service and Mission in America. And I think the reason I left national offices, in addition to becoming a bit tired of traveling, was that I felt it was time to belong someplace again. One of the problems with being on a national staff is you travel around and you have many good friends, but see them very seldom. And the feedback loop is very extended when you're in a national staff. In the parish, I recall that if a sermon bombed, you heard about it probably that day as people left church, or certainly the next day. Or if you were involved in some personal way with the family, through a loss experience or a celebration, and my involvement had been meaningful to them, they would say so. And that was very important. But in national staff, it would often happen a year later, someone would say, "Boy, that was a terrible speech you gave." Or, "I sure enjoyed that training experience that I was in with you." So the loop was very large. So I decided I'd like to belong and settle down. And I felt that a field that interested me, that I worked with for the last 3.5-4 years while I was with national staff, was ministry to the aged and aging. There are many similarities, I think, between youth ministry in the 50s and aging ministry in the 80s and 90s. Some of those I have already identified in our previous sessions, so I won't go through that again. For the newcomers, there are a couple books in the bookstore that are resources for our week with these topics. One is by the very popular host of Over Easy, Hugh Downs, 30 Dirty Lies About Old. It's in a paperback, inexpensive, and deals with some of the myths that we'll be talking about this evening, myths and stereotypes, trying to dispel those and increase the public consciousness about the truth as it relates to being old in America, or being old, period. The other book is quite interesting. It's filled with cartoons, but some provocative short essays. It's entitled Everybody Studying Us, and it's written by a woman from California who is herself a senior, is older. And I think the thrust of the book in its essence is not only that everybody's studying old people today, but also that aging is not an illness, it's not a disease, rather it's a season. And both of those books I would heartily recommend to you. Hugh Downs, when I happened to have the opportunity, as I've indicated on other occasions, to be with him last Friday, told a story about his dad that I think illustrates some of the problems that confront the aging experience for all of us. Hugh Downs' father is 84 years old, and one day he was back home visiting with his dad in Lima, Ohio, and his dad was just beside himself, just was in a rage. And Hugh said, "You know, what's wrong?" And he said, "Oh, I lost my checkbook." And he was mad. And his dad went on, he said, "You know, I'm getting old, forgetful, And he said, I'm misplacing and losing things all the time. And Hugh Downs laughed at his dad, and then he sort of straightened him up, as a son can do sometimes to his dad. And he said, Dad, you know, at 35 you were forgetful. You're probably less forgetful today than you were when I was a child. You've always lost things. But see, he had started to buy into one of the myths, and that is that when you're old, your memory starts to go and you begin to lose things. My mother-in-law goes through the same thing, and when she comes, she is so careful where she puts something so she can find it. Well, I have lists on my desk at the office. I have lists at home. I have lists in the bedroom of things I'm supposed to do so I won't forget, and inevitably misplace my checkbook or something like that. So tonight we want to talk a little bit about that whole subject. A couple of quotes that I find meaningful. One is by a Vista volunteer that addresses the relationship between the young and the old, which is very germane to any dispelling of myths, I believe. The Vista volunteer said this: in the country of the young, old people move like shadows. They have preceded us as travelers in the land of youth, but we rarely stop to ask them the way, to remember that they were young is to realize that we will be old. I think she captured something in her thoughts. That's powerful. Someone else has said that enthusiasm in maturity, that's the great trick of life. Enthusiasm in maturity, that's the great trick of life. How wonderful to see someone who is aging into the older years and still has some vibrancy, some electricity in their personality and in their step. Like the lady the other day who hiked up to Heart Lake, like the gentleman the other night that sang a solo in Norwegian for us. People who physically, though they may be stooped and they may be graying and they may be a bit slower, physically still have a vibrancy to life. One of the myths that I get a kick out of is the one about not being able to remember family names and family relationships. In our family, there were three boys, Bob, Jerry, and Glenn, and I remember my dad many times when he wanted me, it would be Bob, Jerry, Glenn. Forgetting, you know, that I was Glenn, he could have skipped the first two. That's some years ago now. My brother Bob lives in Tampa, Florida, and he comes up on occasion when he works up in our part of the country. He has his oldest son, his name is Greg. For the first day or so he's there, he's calling me Greg. I now have two sons, Stephen and Dwight, and a daughter, Valerie. It's happened many times that in a moment, you know, I'm looking at Dwight and I'm saying, Steve, Dwight, Valerie, knowing that they fit in there someplace. But it's easy to become confused sometimes when you've got a lot of things in your head. Some of our attitudes toward aging and the aged are reflected in words. Codger, duffer, and goat. I think those words are often preceded by a word, aren't they? That old codger, that old duffer, that old goat. And yet I would bet that those people that we identify that way were probably codgers, duffers, and goats when they were young too. But they weren't referred to in that language. They were, at that time, whippersnappers. You remember that one? And upstarts. And bucks. Young bucks. Young whippersnappers. Young upstarts. Now, those words carry not a great deal of truth, but maybe they describe a personality, a lifestyle, a way of behaving that's not really associated too much with being old or being young. It's more illustrative of the person. Before I discuss with you tonight, and I hope we can have some two-way discussion as we cover a few myths, maybe six or seven of them, I'd like to just review and then add a few facts to the discussion, because it's important that, in my mind at least, that we understand and have a grasp of some facts that have some substance before we begin to deflate some myths. The first one is, when we talk about the old, we need to realize, as I'm sure you do, that there are three groups of old today. And I suppose that will be changing again as the longevity continues. John Mason refers in his book to the fourth generation. That's something of this whole idea of understanding that there are different groupings within the category that we call old. There is the young old. That's usually thought of as somewhere around the mid-60s to mid-70s. Without getting locked into those figures, I think you understand those are very much the young old. Then we have the old, more normative, I suppose, someone's mid-70s to mid-80s. Many times when people hit 80, they feel that's at least it was a major milestone. Today, however, we have emerging one of the fastest growing segments of the population, increased by 45% in the last year alone. And that's the age group 85 on up, the old, old. We're very aware that those individuals sometimes tend to be more frail. We'll refer to it later. I'm not using frail as being synonymous with being senile. We'll talk about that a bit later. Frail simply meaning that they may have a handicap or multiple handicaps in some cases. But those are the people who need some type of, not all people in that age group, but more higher percentage of them need some type of secure environment or some type of assistance. Another fact for you, by the year 2030, there will be 55 million people over the age of 65. By 2030. By the year 2000, there will be about 32 to 33 million people over the age of 65. And today, there are approximately 22 to 23 million. So between this day and 2030, less than 50 years, slightly from now, we will have more than doubled the number of people who are over age 65. Needless to say, I'm sure you're aware, at least a general way, of these facts. Now you, I'm sure, understand why the Social Security system has such a poor forecast given to it. In the last national election, we had 10% of our population over 65. In the last election, 17% of the voters were over age 65. We talked last night a bit in the politics of generations about gray power and about seniors voting on certain issues somewhat as a block, and I think we identified a few of those issues, particularly bonding legislation or votes for school issues. Another fact, between now and the year 2000, the proportion of minority people over 65 is expected to increase by 60%. If you would go to visit nursing homes in this country, and there are 20,000 of them, and you would look for minorities, you would find very, very few. There's many reasons for that. One is that the life expectancies for some minorities is less than it is for whites. Also, I think in many minorities, the family structure has been more supportive than ours has been in the white community. So they've received some support in their family environment. But minorities will be increasing considerably in this next 20-year period. Another fact related to life expectancy. Between the years 1900 and 1970, from the material that I've been reading, and I suspect it's fairly close to being accurate, life expectancy in that 70-year period increased by 2 years. In a decade, from 1965 to 1975, life expectancy increased by 1.5 years. In other words, the last 10 years or so, due to more awareness on the part of all of us about health habits and diet and other such things, smoking, I think, have improved lifestyles as it relates to health, and people have, and we are extending life expectancy. If you...
What is it now for men and women in the U.S.?
Okay, yeah, it's... Next point. Good. I wanted you to ask that, but I was going to look at you first. You beat me to it. Thank you, Chuck. If you reach age 65, I'll give it to you two ways. If you reach age 65, if you're 65 now, you can anticipate a life expectancy to 81. Now, if you're my age today, my life expectancy would be around 12.7, around 68, around 78. In other words, if you live to be 65, your life expectancy is longer than if you're my age and you look at life expectancy. Yes, for men. A 65-year-old, no, anyone who lives to be 65, male or female, the projection is that their life expectancy would be 81. A male, 46, my age, would have a life expectancy of about 77, 78. Now, but as it's pushing out, I suspect that's going to increase also. If a person lives to be 85, a person is 85, their life expectancy is 91. So you can see what's happened as compared to the time, for example, just before World War II in the 30s, when life expectancy was nowhere near what we're talking about now. When a person hit 65, they did not as a mass. There were a lot of people that lived, maybe some of your grandparents, to be 80, but as a general rule, they were the exception. Now, those are some facts that I thought might be checked.
At birth today in America, what is the difference in life expectancy between men and women? Do you know that?
I think, no, I don't know absolutely, but I think it's about 4.5 years. Does anyone know for sure?
Joe Bash said last week 7 years, but he wasn't sure what year that data came from. But he was pointing out that there's a gap.
I think I read last week, I don't know if it's what the source was, that it's getting closer and it's less than 5 years.
Yeah, he said it's reducing.
Yeah, I thought it was like 4.8, but I'm...
Not as much anymore.
Yeah. But there still is a difference. But if you hit certain ages, such as 65, regardless of what you are, your life expectancy is pretty good. Okay, any other questions on those facts?
What's the life expectancy of 180 at the present day?
Well, I think on the material that I read, they were conjecturing that an 85-year-old would have a life expectancy of about 91. An 80-year-old, I suppose, would have a life expectancy of another 6-7 years.
Mm-hmm.
But it keeps pushing out. That's one of the things that continues to confuse the prognosticators and please the life insurance companies. But not people who write annuities. Lady back here, did you have a question?
Oh, one of the classes that I took on retirement that Boeing gave
the man told, or I guess it was a lady, told us that if we took the ages of all our grandparents on their death, if we knew them, and the age of our parents, assuming that they lived a natural life, didn't get killed in an accident or something like that, and then divided it by that number that we knew, that would be just about what we would, assuming everything went along smoothly. No serious illness or no accident.
I think that is generally accepted. That's one of the myths I was going to, however, take on. And we'll get to that in a bit. The myth being that the length of the life of your parents has an effect or a relationship to how long you will live. That is a myth. And I'll address it later, but it you may still want to use the formula because if either one of us are wrong, I don't know that we'll be around to tell the other person. Please.
Did I understand you to say that from 1900 to 1970, the average life expectancy increased only 2 years?
That's right. And in the decade from 65 to 75, it increased about a year and a half.
It would have gone up 5-10 years.
No. I was active in the American Heart Association in the early 60s. And the American Heart Association is very big on education, as you know, about smoking and all the rest. And that information, I don't know, you know, that's about 20 years ago, was very new. I mean, when we went out and told people how to prevent heart attacks and the effect of stress and, you know, all that was new information 20 years ago. I'm sure many of us think that's been around. It hasn't. A lot of the information that has related to lifestyle, I think Kennedy's fitness program was a part of the first that I recall of a national leader getting onto that whole thing, that it made a difference how you lived. You know.
May I ask a question regarding that small increase in the life expectancy during 70 years? Would the First World War and the Second World War be a rather decisive factor in keeping that down?
I hadn't thought of that. I would presume it would have to, wouldn't it? Yes. Yeah. Again, I'm not a statistician. Whether these are accurate to the specific, I don't know. My experience would tell me, as I've just indicated, that from probably early 60s, late 50s on, I'm sure there's been a dramatic change, because that, in my judgment, is when the education began with some force in our society about lifestyle. But I'm sure that's a good point. Yes?
About the ages of between men and women and they're closing in on their death, I guess.
Yes.
It's not too long ago, maybe it's a myth too, but because when women start to smoke, it's much more difficult to get them to stop than it is for men. And because of this, their life expectancy has been trimmed a little. This is what I had heard and it's been advertised as such.
Also, they're getting into the working world, so there's more stress.
Yeah, I would think it may relate to that too. One disappointment I had going into the field of healthcare, in terms of working with elderly long-term care, the thing I enjoy are the number of women that are in that field, because in the national office where I worked, it was essentially a male world, and now I'm working more in a female environment, or at least a male-female world. But are the practice of smoking heavily? I smoke a pipe. Not to smoke a pipe for me is something I can live with, but I enjoy it. At work, I get to the point where I can't stand the pipe because the cigarette smoke is so thick in meeting rooms, and now they've come up with reports saying that I could just as well be smoking cigarettes if I'm breathing in all their smoke. But nurses, nursing assistants, direct service people in my field, heavy smokers. Oh, it's just deadly.
How about physicians?
No, I see, that's more on the acute side. And Well, I'm on the board of a large hospital group in Minneapolis Health Central, and there they have a lot of physicians. And come to think of it, there's no smoking at board meetings.
Yeah, I've read that the incidence among physicians is much lower than the general population.
And see, the physicians started much of the work in American Heart Association. Let me share with you some of the myths then, now that we've dealt with a few of the facts. One of the things I wanted to say also is there is an assumption that does exist among many of us, and maybe particularly among young people, that when you're old, you somehow are going to feel different. And that when you're old, you're not going to be quite the same as you were when you were young. I think you know from your experience as you've aged, but in talking to also of people who are older than you are, that essentially they may have changed physically in their appearance. They may have changed somewhat in their hearing or their vision. Their skin texture and some other things may have changed. But basically they will tell you, and I think you know it from your own experience, that on the inside you're the same. You have the same capabilities. You have basically the same needs and the same desires. That doesn't really change. And yet there is sort of that idea that when you're old you don't have those. And so the hugging and the embracing and the whole sexuality relationship between male and female isn't any less when you're old. The capacity's there and the need is there.
Well, it reminded me of my high school's 50th reunion. And going back, I hadn't seen these people. That was back in Illinois, and I lived in California, and I really hadn't seen the people in my class. There were about 30 in our class. About 16 came to the reunion. It was interesting. There were a couple of them I wouldn't have recognized just looking at them. But the minute they started to talk, the same personality came out, the same type of voice, and it just seemed like we were back in high school because everybody was just like they were in as far as their personality and voices and everything was concerned. But they say that the way you are when you're young, when you get old, you'll just be more so.
So I said the other night, if you are a if a person is cantankerous and bitchy when they're old, they probably were when they were young.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh,
that's great. She said, that's discouraging.
That's what's frightening to me, that all these traits that you can kind of keep hidden when you're younger just come out so intensely when you're older, it seems to me. Or it's kind of like, it doesn't matter because I'm past 75 or 80 or something, so I can be any way I want to be.
I don't know if that's, well, that could be, you know, that's, again, it's hard to separate the empirical from sort of a theoretical. Yes, I've experienced that too. On the other hand, on a theoretical base, a person who is flexible, easygoing, can adapt to circumstances that are uncomfortable when they're young, will be that way when they're old. I think the person who is tactful at 25 will probably be tactful at 75. But I know what you're saying. Some of the traits tend to get accentuated, or maybe we're just more honest.
We do.
About the way we always felt when we're old, and we covered it up, and now the more real self is coming out.
I say we do learn as we live. We have, it's a continuous learning process, and we learn better how to get along with other people. And
yes.
What to do, it isn't necessarily that.
Learn the whole art of coping.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
My mom is 77, and she religiously does crossword puzzles every day. because she claims she's warding off senility by exercising her brain. Do you think there's any truth to that?
I think so.
She says it's very important to you.
The real question is, what do you do?
You've got to do something, even when you're 35, right?
No, I think one of the very significant myths is that when you're old, the greatest enemy you have is senility. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to repeat something I have said earlier because it may have not been too clear when I said it the other evening. Senility is essentially a myth, with the exception that there is something that can physically happen to your brain. A number of different diseases, usually put under the heading of chronic brain syndrome. The likelihood of having brain deterioration or chronic brain syndrome when you're old is no more frequent than if you were young. So that an 18-year-old has the same possibility of losing their brain capacity, becoming senile, as a person who's 80. Okay, and I'm talking now about physical deterioration of the brain. However, what has been happening in society is senility is a really bad word. It should be banned from our vocabulary. It's highly judgmental. It's ageist. It's prejudiced. The fact is that if an individual, regardless of age, but certainly if they're old, if a person receives inadequate nutrition, okay, poor diet, is isolated from social interaction so that they flirt with depression, and is deprived through most frequently institutionalization of their privacy and sense of self-worth, they will show signs of confusion. In fact, it's my belief that any of us would. And you wouldn't realize any longer whether today is, or what day is today? Does anybody know?
Thursday.
Well, after you're here in Holden, did you just come today?
No.
After you're here a while, you don't know what day it is. But see, many of us aren't called senile. But you do lose track after a while. But poor nutrition, loneliness, and depriving you of privacy begins to leave you confused. Now, the positive side is, that the way to avoid being old is keep moving, but it's also true in terms of the brain, that the advantage of the crossword puzzle or any intellectual activity is the brain keeps functioning. That has nothing to do with being old, but it's true at age 18. If you keep using your brain, it will respond more quickly and will retain more knowledge than if you allow it to be dormant. But it's the fear of senility that is the curse on the back of old people, and they go into a nursing home where we have 4% of the population over 65, 96% are not nursing homes, go into nursing home and become convinced, as young people do, that that's normative, to be incontinent, incoherent, and all the rest. We'll be talking tomorrow about how to pick a nursing home, which is very important, I think, to know. But one of the keys is to find a place where they do rehab. It's possible, if the confusion is caused by nutrition, loneliness, and those other factors, to rehab and recapture one's memory. Memory development is nothing more than that. Mary?
Well, what about arteriosclerosis?
That and chronic brain syndrome, the whole blood pressure thing, can and does have an effect on memory. Very small percent of the elderly population. See, the myth is that most all old people must have that. A good friend of mine who is 54 has hardening of the arteries. You know, and he's being treated for it now, and the doctor indicates that he will, because they caught it and he's being treated for it, it will not be a problem. If that had been untreated and he had hit 75, I suspect he would have been in pretty bad shape.
Where does Alzheimer's, is that how you pronounce it?
Yeah.
Alzheimer's disease.
That's brain deterioration, and that too is can happen at any age.
Why is it
happened with a friend of ours at an age when, you know, we would say that person is senile. It isn't that. It's non-repairable, permanent brain damage and dysfunction.
It seems like most of the patients in nursing homes have had strokes, hypertension, Alzheimer's disease, CVA, chronic brain syndrome. They'll have almost all of them combined, or half of them, or one of them. Those are the things that seem to put them there. I've worked in a nursing home, and you know, from what I've witnessed.
Well, that's partially true. Most people go into a long-term care facility or a nursing home because of some type of loss. A loss of a spouse, a loss of ability to walk, a loss of a home, whatever. Most people in nursing homes are not that way, but they may look that way, if that makes sense to you. One of the big problems is the use of drugs. In our organization, the first thing we do is clean people out, you know. I mean, one of the problems is they come in a stupor because they never throw a prescription away, because they may re-get, you know, the disease that they had it for 4 years ago. They can still use those pills that are left, or they've got pills contradicting each other. And we find if you can get people back to a normal functioning with minimal medication, their personality does start to come out. We have about 850 people in our nursing home, and I suppose we might have 10% that would have chronic behavior or brain problems. But I agree with you, you go into some nursing homes, it looks like everyone is. Now part of that, the institution has created that. You know, you take away all your personal belongings, you have to undress in front of people, the food is slopped at you, nobody comes to visit you, you lose your will to live, pretty soon you're, quote, senile. You withdraw into that which you remember from years ago that was meaningful, and you relive the past. We've done... In our home, we have our people bake bread, bake cookies. Just the aroma of freshly baked bread in the hall of a nursing home will bring some people whom you think are just totally out of it back to consciousness, because it recalls for them pleasant experiences. And but yeah, without a strong therapy program, I think you're right. But I wonder if it isn't more visual, more the way it appears than the way it is.
Every patient I took care of, they had one or a couple of all those things I listed and more, diabetes,
yes,
atherosclerosis. And
one of the big issues is whether people should be integrated or segregated, and I don't know if yours were segregated in that setting or integrated. The issue is, should confused elderly be integrated in an institutional setting with other, quote, normal people? Or should they be kept on floors by themselves?
Well, they had different wings. One wing was for those that were almost completely bedridden or had needed more care, and another wing for those that could dress themselves, walk to the dining room, you know, ambulate. Yeah. So they separated them that way.
There's some work that's being done, and not enough has been done, to do some applied research in this whole area of integration. Whether in fact it can be effective in influencing a person who is withdrawn and confused to have them with someone who is, unquote, normal. One of the real myths is that we know a lot about aging. One of the facts is we know very little about aging. We need to do considerably more out of mostly national institutes like the National Institute of Mental Health, the National Institute on Aging. All the national institutes have in some way or another done research in aging. We know very little about the aging process. We also need a great deal more done in the area of applied research, experimenting with different ways of reaching people who have withdrawn or people who have shown a combination of disabilities. One of the points that we were discussing last night is that we have not figured out in our society at all how to cope with or provide life-giving experience and opportunity to the aged with multiple disabilities. When they have two or three or four or five, there's no mechanism set up in our society to cope with that kind of person, to provide life-giving, life-sustaining environments. So what happens is they get stored out of sight, out of mind, and that's what we call locked wards in nursing homes.
But isn't that, I think our social program is really trying to help keep people in their own homes for that purpose, aren't they? And you know, they'll have home nursing care or provide a lot of different social care so that people can stay in their homes as long as possible now rather than...
I think that is the ideal and probably what everybody in this room wants, is what I want. Our organization and many others have had some first-hand experiences with that, and it's an absolute disaster because the federal and state reimbursement mechanisms in our society are essentially geared to putting people in institutions. And dollars are not, and it does not appear will be, available to provide alternatives for older persons. As I've told some of you, we have lost over $750,000 in the last 5 years subsidizing our in-home program. We serve about 1,500 people in their homes. Homemaker, home health aide, visiting nurse, protective services, daycare. The problem is, if you're absolutely destitute financially, it is possible to get some county assistance for in-home care. Most elderly are poor, and we got into an argument on that a little bit the other night, but are not destitute. Meaning that according to the poverty level, or according to the norm of society by which you need to live, even with a lifestyle such as we discuss and practice here at Holden, it's very difficult to do that if your income is $400 a month, $4,800 a year. There are people in those, they're not destitute, but they're the near poor, who cannot qualify for some of the public assistance programs for in-home care. That's the group that we need to get some new legislation through to provide services. So in our organization, 1 hour of in-home care by a homemaker cost us about $8.20 an hour. We had a sliding scale according to the person's income. So some would pay $1, $2, $3, 50 cents, $4. Any difference between whatever they paid, let's say they paid $5, and $8.20 was a subsidy. And there's nobody to subsidize it. The church can, as we did in our organization, which was owned by the church for a while, but when you get up to $750,000, you can't do it any longer. The money that seems to be coming down now by the planners, that's reflected in the planning, money that will be coming down, seems to be back in the mentality of building more nursing homes. So we've got a real public policy issue on our hands that regrettably the church that we represent, many of us here, has not taken a position on. has not done any lobbying in Washington. The professional organization that I belong to and that nonprofits belong to has. Claude Pepper is supportive of it. His motive, representative from Florida, his motive, and he's himself about 81, is that in-home care is better because it's cheaper than nursing home care. Our experience has been that may not be true. We're not sure. We would promote it because it's better, because it affirms dignity, self-determination, independence, functioning in society. So I'm with you, but the facts are against what you believe in and I believe in. And we've got to get that message out, and frankly, we've got to fight on our hands. Because the control of the power structure of this society is by middle class people who already feel old people are ripping them off because their Social Security went up. And you know, we've got that animosity between generations already, and then a lot of ignorance as to, which is what we're talking about, some of the myths of aging.
I was going to say, I worked as an activity director in a nursing home for 9 years, and now I'm working as a volunteer in the home care thing. But to me, a person, one person living alone in a house are very lonely compared if you're in a nursing home and there's other people around. If it's a couple, you know, that are together, I can see staying in the home.
And of course, most people over 65
are
women.
Yes, and they're alone, and where you're in a nursing home, you have activities to go to.
What is happening, of course, if a person's in a neighborhood where they have a lot of friends, that they've got enough, but then all their friends die, you know, if you live long enough, and that's a little tough one to deal with. What we have done, and many others in the country have done, is to promote and develop housing for the elderly. Now, there are some negatives with it that we need to be careful we don't segregate the elderly population. As has been said, you know, if we build housing, we should build it by playgrounds and zoos, so that there's interaction with all of life. In a housing environment that is congregate, that usually is the best. A congregate living environment is usually a rental situation, most often funded by HUD, Housing and Urban Development, need not be. And what it provides is one meal a day. In our organization, the meal is mandatory. And I think from what I've said, you know why it is. Okay? But one meal a day, which takes care of nutrition, hopefully, and socialization. Also, a supportive environment so that if the person needs some temporary support, social worker, visiting nurse, it's there. And an environment that's barrier-free and flexible, so that if the person needs a wheelchair, a walker, and so forth, the building, you know, they can stay there. We've got 46 high-rises in our metropolitan area under the Housing Authority, most of which, if you needed a walker, you're evicted. You see, that's counterproductive. Loss increases aging. Losing your home, having to move when you're 80 is traumatic. It's traumatic enough when you're 20. So I think what we're trying to do is develop more housing options. Not that I think everybody should move into an Ebenezer housing project or a Hearthstone housing project, but what you're saying is true. There are some people where, contrary to what we might feel, living in their home is not the greatest thing in the world. They're rather unhappy there, because they're lonesome, they're too far from their church, they're too far from the market, they don't have a car, public transportation, which you talked about last night, is inadequate. They'd be better in an environment. Even if it is a little institutional, it's still not as institutional as a nursing home.
If they have all these things they've had all these years and you don't want to give them up.
Yeah.
So, you know, you stay.
We've also done a great deal of work in cooperatives, and we don't have time to get into that tonight, but I think that's a new model that I think goes one step beyond even congregate housing, where the people can own, manage it, govern it themselves, retain their equity and have their equity increase with inflation. And when they move out, they get it all back. It's a pretty good model. Let me share with you, I think we're just about out of time. I'll just have to pick one. I was going to talk about this one. Here's one of the myths. You won't live long if your parents didn't. How many people here are older now than one of their parents were when they died? You see, no one dies, and you may not agree with this, but I think it can be supported by those who are smarter than I. No one dies really from being old. I think we've all stood at deathbeds where someone's got so old we've said they've slept away. We very much feel like they've just aged into death. But the fact is nobody really dies from being old. Something happens, something malfunctions, there's some disease, or they've, as I thought we heard so well this morning from Fritz Norstedt relating the difference between disease and illness, they may just give up. But that's not, you can give up when you're 22, not only when you're 80. There is little correlation between how old your parents were and how old you live to be. What affects it as much as anything is lifestyle. If you are engaged in good health habits related to diet and exercise, particularly in the whole area of smoking, if you minimize rather than maximize your access to stress as you age, in other words, a person who is gung-ho for whatever might come and willing to take on all the stress in the world, even when they're 80, is probably going to have that show some way in them physically. There's a limit to how much you can take. If it starts bothering you, there's a limit there. So health habits, the whole area of stress. If you plan for your later years so that you know you're not going to have days without meaning or worthlessness, but you plan for growth, for continuing life and learning, there's really no reason why a person would die when their parents die. So that correlation, which I think is generally sort of believed to be true, isn't. My father died at age 65. He retired at 65 and Bangle died. Died of heart trouble. And had some heart problems a couple years before that. Was extremely overweight. My two brothers and I are built and would be inclined to go the same way. We have all been into the whole running thing, the eating sensibly thing most of the time, and have pretty much convinced ourselves we're not going to end up overweight. He smoked cigarettes extensively. None of us smoked cigarettes. He tended to work very, very hard at anything he did. Playing golf was he did it with very little relaxation. Now, he died, that doesn't mean I'm going to die at age 65 because I'm not doing what he did. I may die at age 60 because of an airplane crash or being struck by lightning, but that's unrelated and isn't related to being old.